So if you've been told that you have a weak core or that your low back pain is coming from a lack of core strength, and you think that doing a bunch of crunching is going to be your solution, we are going to ask you kindly to stop doing that. We'll talk about why that's not the best idea and some alternatives that can actually provide you with the thing that you're actually looking to do. All of that today on this week's episode of
Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking, and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
Okay, crunches.
I love that.
So when I consult with people and they have back pain or they're dealing with a hip or a knee thing, and we slow them down and we take them out of a lot of the activities that are interference, they have this urge to want to keep training and doing some of the stuff that they were already doing. A lot of them want to ask if they can do core exercises or if they can keep doing crunches that they've been doing. And I have to tell them no. And the reasons for that, I kind of want to get into with this episode, because I don't think people understand the negative secondary consequences of doing these certain like ab exercises.
Yes.
So let's kind of start with that.
Well, I think where that comes from is sort of the isolative perspective. And we could probably pick on bodybuilding for that, because bodybuilding is always segmented your body into pieces. And it's like, you train this piece with this exercise, you train this piece with this exercise. And so then the implication is, it's like, oh, and when people think about the abdominal region, they think about the aesthetic, right? The structure of rectus abdominis is what most people are attempting to sort of construct in this overall aesthetic, because it's been associated with a favorable appearance versus the resultant behavior that would be associated with constraining essentially a certain segment of your body. And when people are trained, or if they have issues controlling the center of gravity, we're always moving forward. And as the system moves forward inside of its base of support, one of the resultant strategies that you would use so you don't fall outside of your base of support is actually pulling down on the front side of your body, which we can give a lot of credit to rectus abdominis.
Because your six pack muscles.
Sure. If I am already influenced by a recruitment of that muscle to hold my position in space, and then I continue to emphasize it in a movement that would either magnify the current strategy or create an additive strategy that compromises my overall movement, then I have some pretty significant consequences. Give you a for instance, and you can test this on yourself. If you were sitting upright in your chair and you reach as high as you can overhead, and you sort of take that little measurement there, and then if you constrain the anterior abdominal wall by pulling down on the sternum as you would, as a crunch, right? And you can see that your arm drifts out of that position, and it becomes a limiting factor. And so again, what you're reinforcing or adding a strategy that eventually compromises your potential, orthopedic health for many number of reasons.
Yeah.
You lose the ability to turn. Everything that you do is based on a turn. And then you can sort of, by eliminating options, you sort of stick yourself in a place where you just don't have normal access. And then you wonder why you get like little ache here, a little pain there, or I can't move like I used to, kind of a thing. It's not an instantaneous change in behavior, but it does become a reinforcement of it.
Yeah.
And so that becomes a problem, right? Because everything we talk about is a movement strategy. And by, again, being isolative in your approach, you create emphasis. It's not really isolation, it's just emphasis. and your skeleton adapts to that, your breathing adapts to that, and then it's just a progressive influence on movement.
Well, yeah, the more you use this group of muscles, these core muscles that crunch you, that bring your sternum towards your pelvis, the more you use that, the more you recruit those muscles, the more your body is going to strategize using those muscles to help you with how you move. Like your behavioral movement strategies will be solely based around this constant compression that you're creating by crunching and then continuing to crunch. So the secondary consequences of that are you are limiting your availability for movement, and your the fallacy here is thinking that some type of something is weak and needs to be strengthened. So if I have a compressive base, like low back pain issue, if I'm adding just compression on the other side of that, I may get symptom relief. Usually don't, honestly, with low back patients and crunching, you're usually not going to see symptomatic relief. It's usually makes people hurt more, in my experience with using this with people or having people that have done this. Because I'm saying, you're just adding more compression on the opposite side.
Well, there's going to be two possibilities that we can narrow this down to for discussion purposes. Okay. So number one, you're adding a compression, and then there's no alternative strategy to make a space to move into. Okay. Right. So we talk about external rotation being a space that we can move into, and then we talk about internal rotation being a downward force. So what the abdominal exercise does is it increases your ability to push down. So it's a higher pressure strategy. So I can actually push harder into the ground. So that's going to compromise vertical dimension, the ability to expand the thorax. An expanded thorax gives you options to move, right? However, if I have the capacity within my structure, and this is not everybody, but if I have the capacity within my structure and I do increase that compressive strategy, I could create a secondary compensatory strategy in the spine that would actually increase the amount of space that would be available to move in this compressed state. So let me give you a for instance. So we talk about anti-orientation a lot because that's your IR substitution in most cases. So center of gravity moves forward inside of the base of support. I increase the anti-orientation of the pelvis, which allows me to push down. That is my attempt to actually slow my progression, my forward progression inside the base of support. Once I reach that point, I have multiple options available, but one of them could be to pull down harder and then actually create the ER of the spine. Okay. For instance, if somebody squats and you see the rounding of the lumbar spine, that's actually the externally rotated position of the spine. It actually creates space for them to squat into, right? It is a compensation in most circumstances, but I could actually utilize that for any position. So if you took, like I said, anybody that's forward in the base of support, they are at threat to fall out. They engage rectus abdominis as an example. And then they actually compress the axial skeleton. So your spine gets compressed, and then it will bow out in the opposing direction that we would typically recognize as the typical curvature of the lumbar spine. So I reduce that, and that actually gives me some space. So I could get symptomatic relief from that perspective. The unfortunate circumstance is that I created a compensation. And now I'm going to use that strategy to try to slow down. So it's like popping out a parachute on the backside of your body to slow down, right?
Right.
And if that's the case, now I have a compromise of the posterior structures of the spine.
So this is where a problem. So when Bill was talking about the rounding of the low back and the squat, that's typically anyone that's coming to this episode about crunches and they are familiar with like what someone would term as like a butt wink in a squat. And I know Bill doesn't want to say that, but what's happening when you see the pelvis tuck under is you're creating space. You're crunching down in front to create ER space or a rounding in the low back or a kyphosis in the low back. Right.
Yes.
Right.
The rule is to squat deep. I need enough space, enough external rotation space to do that. And so, again, this is why this is the externally rotated position of the spine when that happens.
Because if you have this compression that Bill's talk about and you do have these anterior orientation strategies that will restrict your sacrum's ability to counternutate and your pelvis's ability to ER to in order to create the space to drop into a squat. Mm-hmm. Well, it's really like the ER leading to the IR shape back to the ER shape. But that's for a different
episode. It's a compensatory external rotation shape.
Sure.
And so again, that's why, because it's not relative movement between the segments. So the lumbar spine is moving as a single, you compress the spine and then you actually bend it in that posterior direction.
Right.
The pelvis is not moving as three separate bones anymore. So you have a lumbar spine, you have a pelvis that are essentially behaving as one and bending itself into this position. The unfortunate circumstance is that in many cases, there is freedom of movement that is felt. It's like, oh, that's easier, but really you did create a space for you to move into. It's just the unfortunate circumstance of that strategy and then the secondary consequences that are associated with it.
Okay. So we've talked about
eventually why. I will compromise structure.
So we're giving reasons for why not to do these things. Let's actually help people understand a little bit better, because we never use the C word. We don't like to talk about core muscles, but let's actually give people an alternative here. So when someone's referring to the core, they're typically referring to inner and outer core muscles that create this sort of canister when they're looking at the anatomical representation. So they're going to have like your transverse abdominis, your multifidi, your diaphragm and your thorax, your pelvic, what someone would say pelvic floor or the pelvic outlet as the bottom.
Outlet would be a better choice.
Right. We would use
definition.
Outlet. Someone would say floor, but that creates this inner canister representation. And then you have the outer muscles that we're talking about that would typically be contributing to crunching, which would be your rectus abdominis, which is your six pack, your internal and external obliques. And then there's, the other things that all connect on the outside of that inner canister. Like what are those muscles actually doing? Like what is their function in the body when we talk about movement as behavioral representation? And then how do we get people to sort of understand how you would train in a way that would be conducive to helping these things develop in a way that helps you move with relative motions when you need to, with performance capacity when you need to?
that was a big long list.
Well, I want to first talk about what those muscles, why there isn't a core, what those muscles that people think were or are the core, what they're actually doing, like what their actual purpose is. And then we can talk about how to train.
Yeah. So they either guide you to move forward. Right. I can move forward slowly. I can move forward quickly, or I can stop.
Yeah.
Right. And then so the greater the magnitude of compression, the more stop you have, which means no movement, which is a reduction of movement. Right. And so and the reason that the perceived bottom of the pelvis, it's not the bottom, it's the front. It is moving. It creates the guidance to allow us to move forward. So if you could concentrically orient the anterior outlet. So it's literally the anterior side, right? If I could concentrically orient that actually produces a stop, right? That's why a lot of people can't squat deep there's multiple reasons why, but this is one of them, is that if I cannot eccentrically orient that anterior outlet, I have no forward direction, which means that I have to come to a stop. Right. So if I create strategies that increase the intra-abdominal pressure to a significant degree, great, very, very stable for me to stack stuff on, right, to lift heavy things. But it's, again, it's a compromise to movement, because a deep squat is still a forward progression of the body. And so, again, if you start driving compressive strategies, you're teaching yourself not to move. And again, that's the, again, if that's what you want to do, I suppose that would be okay. If you make a living out of lifting heavy things, there would be certainly some performance related benefits. See, that's the other kicker, is like, okay, high pressure strategies are very useful in performance, but again, you're compromising another element of movement, which would then compromise health. You think about, you take your big long list of muscles. It's like, do I really want to constrain myself if I'm a dynamic individual? So if I'm an athlete, or I'm trying to alleviate some complaint, like back pain, hip pain, shoulder pain, whatever it might be. It's like the last thing that I would want to do is to create a solid piece of me that doesn't move. And that's the consequence of overemphasis on an isolative or again, emphasis type of strategy from an exercise standpoint. Because all I'm going to end up doing is compromise. It might be great for a while, right? Because it's not an instantaneous loss. It is a progressive kind of a thing, which again, people need to understand. It's like, and then you get the compromise of, well, can I do this once in a while? It's like, okay, once in a while, probably you can get away with it. But if it becomes your standard of behavior, then you're at risk to compromise all of your movement.
Yeah. Health. I mean, putting a cast on a broken limb is okay for a while, right? But eventually, if you always have to move with that level of stiffness in that one area, something else is going to give. Like a knee is going to go out. For instance, or
well, there has to be movement somewhere, right?
Yeah. So we can, if in an ideal scenario, we would create space and then superimpose downforce through a space and we just lock that space up. We'll try to create space and put downforce through something else. So this would be like where you'll get a medial knee symptom or some type of wear and tear degeneration at the knee or the ankle or the hip even. These muscles are, they've been talked about as these great stabilizers, and they help sort of transfer forces through the body. And they're this engine that moves the body. But what we're really trying to get people to reconsider them or as just part of a greater system that's trying to put force down into the ground in an efficient way.
Yes. Yeah. And so everything that you do, especially when you're on your feet, would be associated with teaching you how to control the shape of your body. But again, I think the aesthetic is the biggest interference to this, because people think that if I don't do something that makes me feel this directly, that I'm not favorably influencing it. Well, the ultimate solution is the ability to change shape through space as we move through.
Right.
We don't want one representation. We want all representations that would be available to us.
Right.
You know, if I'm doing an upright activity of any kind, you are utilizing that musculature to control the shape and position of your pelvis in space. Right. And so something as simple as, carrying an asymmetrical load, right, would start to increase the emphasis on that. You know, activities that move on diagonals influence this in a very favorable way, actually, because it's promoting the turning capabilities of the entire system. So we're not constraining the system from turning, but we're actually engaging all of the same musculature in a very intensive and effective way.
Yeah, and there's a reason why. So important caveats to what Bill just said. So Bill kind of mentioned like anything on your feet. I would say as long as you are within your base of support as a starting condition and you have ground contacts.
Yeah.
You have an even distributed ground contact.
Yeah. But we can take people off of their feet as well, put them down on the ground. And you talk about like any type of rolling activity, arm bars.
Yeah.
Anything where you're going through the phases of propulsion, regardless of your position, you have to engage this musculature to actually execute. And this is why we spend a lot of time on the ground, because we're taking advantage of those ground contacts through other segments of the body. And now we're actually intensifying the activity of this musculature.
Yeah, that was a good clarification, because I had said ground contact and not specifically foot contacts, because the ground, like Bill said, laying on your back, laying on your side, on your elbow, hip, knee on the ground, that becomes your foot, right? Like that's your representation of your contact with the ground.
Yes.
But that's a big point that I have to try to make to people when I'm working with them or consulting, is that all of these movements that we're going to be doing are not going to be, there's going to be no focus in isolation, because your body is just one tube that just works together as a system.
Right.
So there is no isolated, there is no arm day. Even when you're doing bicep curls, you're still grounded. You're still, everything else is still working in order to get this pressure to move throughout the body.
Yes.
So that's an important thing to you. What you have to consider though is like how, when we're talking about core training, the fundamentals of core training, the very first steps of core training is like when you breathe in and out, what happens to the system? Do you have this sort of even distribution of expansion and compression, or is air only going to your belly, or is air only going up into your shoulders and your neck? Is the rib cage moving in a way that's conducive to letting that down force go down into the ground and that expansion to go up into the thorax, like Bill had mentioned earlier?
Yes.
Like those are your step ones. And then any training that involves complex movements and moving forward through space will train these core muscles in a way that is conducive to you not feeling whatever symptoms you're feeling or you're dealing with.
Right.
Because you're managing pressure as through forward motion or propulsion.
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, again, the last thing that we want to do is constrain the system, get so good at constraining the system from a health perspective. Again, we need to make this very, very clear that some performance related outcomes benefit from less motion, right? Like if I'm a shot putter, I would rarely expect to see unconstrained full relative motions.
Yeah.
Because the amount of pressure that they have to use is exceptionally high. So they have to bias themselves into these spaces where they do have what we would compare to as restricted ranges of motion. Right. And that's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about this performance related outcome. We're talking about what we're actually compromising from a health perspective as we're executing these activities.
Yeah. Your pole vaulters are going to need to do their little like toe to bar crunchy exercises because that's kind of what they need to lock stuff up.
Right.
And push as hard as they can.
Think about this. They have to create shape changes without a ground contact.
Yeah.
So they've got some bar contact, which is exceptionally useful. But after they release the bar, it's like you're in the air and you literally are relying on your own suspension capabilities and shape changing capabilities. So under those circumstances, that's a whole different world. However, I would also argue that if they were to take it too far, they would compromise their ability to make that shape change in the air.
I've seen it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen pole vaulters and track athletes who focus too much on weight room stuff and crunches and they're high bar drills and their performance suffers from it.
Yes.
Because it's a trade-off. It's a very fine line.
It is always a trade-off. It's like, what am I compromising for the outcome? And so if you're chasing the aesthetic, which again, that seems to be like the, you know, you always get the before and the after kind of a thing where you have the guy that's kind of out of shape. And then, you know, 3 months later, he's showing his after photo and it's like, okay, looks great. But it's like there was a trade-off to achieve that.
Right. And
some people will move more quickly in the direction of compensatory strategy, and some people will move more gradually. And we can't predict that. So we have to speak generally for that reason.
Well, in the reality, I try to break it. This isn't said enough, so I'm going to say it. Not that I feel like we have such a wide-reaching podcast here, but I've worked with some of these celebrities who have been in these movies or had these photo shoots where they have this body and these abs that people want to see. In order to get to that point, it took 10 months of training, an insane amount, and dieting down. And then they did a prep for their shoot, which involved dehydrating themselves to dangerous levels for a 2-hour shoot for a scene where they're getting out of a hot tub. Or they have like a sex scene or something like that.
Yes.
And then they don't look like that at all for the rest of the year. So they trained for 2 hours of a shoot to look that way. It's the same way with bodybuilding competitions. You train to look that way on stage for that one moment in time. And then after that, you're kind of soft in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's like, I want people to really recognize that fact. Is that this isn't something that you should try to live with at all times. And I think people that do try to live like that either. And if they're comfortable in their lifestyle, they're probably just genetically gifted to do that, or they're just miserable And they're the person that goes out with their friends and has to bring Tupperwares of with chicken and broccoli because they can't eat anything. You know, people know people like that. You know, a lot of fitness people are like that.
But I've been there, done that.
Right. And it's kind of a miserable existence. It takes a lot of sacrifice. And there are secondary consequences to motion. Like Bill has two fake hips because he tried to live that life for a long time. And that's something too, where people, when I work with them and we're trying to get, they alleviate their symptoms, their back hasn't bothered them in 2 weeks, but then they're telling me how concerned that they are because when they poke themselves in the stomach, it's not rock hard anymore. Like that's what we're looking to do. Your muscle being concentrically oriented and rock hard all the time is having a parking brake on in your car.
It is.
It is.
It's just a it's a constraint, and it's like you will have to behave within those constraints. You don't have a choice, right? And so we just have to number one, understand what the compromise is. What are you willing to do under that circumstance, and then recognize what the influences are.
Sure.
Right. Versus just looking good in the picture.
Yeah. So I'm gonna give an example of like a workout would be where we're not doing any core training, but a lot of what we're talking about with pressure management and the center of gravity is taken care of. So let's say I'm just going to do like two exercises as my working sets. Mm-hmm. In the beginning of the workout, I'm going to put this person on the ground on their back in a hook lying position to just breathe to make sure everything is moving together on inhale and exhale. Mm-hmm. They're going to exhale in order to kind of feel those muscles that compress work together to compress and put force down through their feet in that hook lying position. Then I'm going to have that person stand up, stand on wedges to put them on a ramp that brings their center of gravity back. And I might put a light weight in their hands to do like a goblet squat. That's going to delay how fast they move forward. It's going to put everything in position like we're talking about so I can expand and compress within the base of support. Yes. I'm using all of the muscles that we had talked about and categorized earlier as core, quote unquote, core muscles in order to do that. And then maybe my secondary exercise is like Bill had mentioned, they're just going to hold a kettlebell in one hand and they're going to walk the length of the weight room and come back. And maybe that's my series. Do some breaths on the ground. Position everything how I would want, get some foot contacts, stand them up to do a goblet squat, and then do like a suitcase carry.
Sure.
That is as much as you would need for core training, as far as we're concerned, because it's actually coherent.
We could have the same conversation about like an offset split squat and a landmine press.
Sure.
And any cable exercise that you can think of that doesn't look like a crunch. And it's like what we're doing is we're trying to limit the trade-off that would be associated with the loss of movement options. That's
fine.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. I don't know. What should we talk about? I don't even know. Like I want to know what everyone's like favorite pizza toppings are. And I want people to have the weird ones to post. I've seen it all at this point. So it's like, I don't think anything is really going to be too weird. I know certain parts of the world, they'll do weird stuff. Like they'll put like bananas on pizza.
Bananas on pizza.
Yeah. I've heard of that. If you're like from Australia or you're like from Portugal and there's some weird, and there's some weird thing that you all put on pizza, like kangaroo or something, just put that in the comments. My.
Kangaroo pepperonis?
The weirdest thing I think I ever put on pizza is like, it's not even that weird, like anchovies sometimes.
Oh, see, that's like an old school kind of a pizza order from like the 1950s kind of a thing. Like,
yeah.
You see people, get an anchovy pizza. It's like, I've never had an anchovy on a pizza.
It's just really like the saltiness of it. If you have a sweet tomato sauce on your pizza, which is the case sometimes, and like the cheese is not super salted. Like if it's just fresh mozzarella, then you put it on there, it's good. But if you have like a salty sauce and really salty, salted mozzarella cheese or pecorino or whatever you put on there, and then you put anchovies, it's a little overkill.
Here you go. This is my once a month pizza order.
Pizza King.
It's definitely Pizza King. It's definitely Pizza King. It's a baked ham, but we order what's called 50-50 sauce. So it's half pizza sauce, half barbecue sauce. And it's not like half and half on the pizza. It's like mixed together, right? So it's called 50-50 sauce. Oh,
killer. Sounds gross.
Killer. Sounds it's gross. Amazing. It's amazing. No, the mixture, like the bite of the barbecue sauce in there is just
of all the times I've been to India, we have never gone to Pizza King when I've.
Well, you wouldn't like it because it's not your. It's not like the. It's not like the because world's thinnest cracker crust.
Because
pizza
it's anymore. Not good.
I don't like cracker crust pizza. That's like tavern style.
You like this, like you like the burnt edges, thin.
I like
you know.
Thin. I like a lot of types of pizza, to be honest. Yeah, I mean, I even like lunch. I even like cafeteria pizza in the lunch.
I'll have to take you to Ale Emporium here in town because that's like the really thick, deep
Detroit style.
Very much so. Very much so. It's awesome.